I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Collecting Cars, the global online marketplace devoted to cars, bikes, and automobilia. A safe, smart, and simple auction experience for everyone. List for free, sell for free, hassle free. Follow us on Instagram at Collecting Cars and also CollectingCars.com. Hello and welcome to a Collecting Cars podcast. It's been a long time. I'm Chris Harris, your host for today. Sorry about my slightly nasal delivery. I recently did the Cinnamon Challenge for a popular TV show and I can't breathe now, so I'll be suing the BBC soon. My guest today is someone called Manish Pandey. Now, those of you that are into the genre of motorsport films will know exactly who he is. Some of you won't. So I'll also introduce him as the man behind, and I think the credit was scriptwriter and producer of?
Senna.
Of Senna, okay, which has to be the greatest motorsport documentary ever produced for me. I think so many of us remember that film. So Manish, thank you for coming on the podcast. This is a very interesting man. He's got a great story to tell. And first of all, I want to launch straight into Senna, how it came to be, how you managed to persuade Senna's family and Formula One and Bernie Ecclestone to get involved. Because this is a smash and grab story for the ages. So Manish, welcome, and take us from the start. Why did you want to make it? How did you make it happen?
I actually loved him. I think that's always a great place to start with people like this. And he was my absolute hero as a teenager. And but I can tell you, everybody remembers Senna for Monaco 1984, driving out through the rain in the Tolman. It's like, yeah, I've watched that race. It was all fantastic. But my first real memory of the man was Murray Walker talking about the 85 season that was coming. And you just saw this black and gold JPS Lotus. And I just saw Senna in that black, in his black overalls. And there was something about him, an incredibly handsome guy, but there was something about his eyes. The way he was looking at this car was, I mean, I've been addicted to Formula One since I was 11, but I'd never seen anyone look at a car like this, walk around a car like this. And meanwhile, Murray Walker is telling you in voiceover, if there's a guy in Formula One who can win the world championship in his first year in a competitive car, you're looking at him. And Murray was God. So if God says that this guy is quite possibly the most God. Naturally...
Exactly. If God says, here's another God.
He must be a God. And I just remember absolutely, I just loved him. I mean, you could do no wrong. And
So here's an interesting thing. Mm. Formatively, we have our racing heroes and your shadows like us. Can you remember who your hero was before Senna came on the scene?
Oh, yeah. No,
who was it?
Oh, God, it was Nelson Piquet. And isn't that a terrible thing to sort of say in the day?
No, so, by the way, Manish is a man of colour.
Exactly. No, just to be interesting. Oh God, no! I say the thing about PK, what I used to love about him, and I guess you would call it a childish sense of humour. And you've got to remember when I was a kid growing up in the kind of, you know, early 80s and things, Formula One started 4 minutes before the race. And it finished with the checkered flag. There was no podium. There were no long bits of intro explaining this guy's into abseiling, this guy's into whatever. What you had was what you got. And PK would always manage, and it was a classic thing to throw some bit of character into what you were watching. And that's why you like these guys. I mean, look at the success of Drive to Survive. They don't need to have massive spills. Just get the drivers out there. They're young, risk-taking, generally, you know.
In that context, I suppose the great shame is that even though we had a sense of how impish PK was, we didn't know the full story of just what a lunatic he was.
So you go
PK to Senna. You're captivated by this gold and also just by the black way, car.
Don't forget that they're both Brazilians, okay? And I am, as you pointed out, a man of colour. So I rather...
As I can say that because I am as well, by the way. For those of you that can't see this, I have no idea who I am. I can say that.
So the joke is, of course, you've got these South Americans coming into a very heavily European sport, and they're obviously white men, but they're tanned white men, and they kind of come to Europe and they're showing kind of all the
there's
European
a whiff of calypso there, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly that. It's exactly that. You've just got this idea that you have these non-Europeans coming in, and they come in, and I love this about Senna more than anything else. He had a rep for being the sort of, you know, wild this, wild that. And, you know, I remember Jackie Stewart tearing him one for, you know, after the accident with Prost, saying, you know, you've been involved in more accidents than anyone else. You've been involved with more, you know, contact, da, 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 da. The truth is also Senna was probably more technical than people give him any credit for. And I think 1988, I think it's a really interesting year because if you look at Prost at the end of that year, the Australian Grand Prix, he won that. And... He says in a sort of, you know, classic Prost way, said, you know, normally at the end of the season, you add up all the points and the person with the most points is the world champion. And this year it was a little bit different and, you know, but no problem at all. You know, so he basically explained to you that he should be world champion, but that Ayrton Senna did it because of some parenthetical issue. But Senna's not stupid. They had the best car, they knew it. It was the guy who was going to win the most races, was going to become the world champion. And that's not because Senna was brash or stupid or whatever. He knew what the rules
were.
That
was Terminator vision.
Correct.
Binary, ones and noughts. I know what I need to do to win here.
And that's exactly, and that's a beautiful way of putting it, was Terminator vision. And I love that focus. I think that focus is just, for me, that's what it was about. And actually, Bernie's often talked to me about, you know, kind of, oh, you know, it's about who wins the most. It is about who wins the most. But actually, do you know what it really is when you're a kid? Actually, no one gives a crap about who wins the most. I care about who's the fastest.
Yeah.
That's what you care about. Who is the fastest?
That's where you get the Villeneuves. That's where you get the people that captivate. Right, we're digressing massively. I've got to you are a slippery eel. I'm going to have to pin you down here.
Okay,
so we need to... So you've gone from
this...
You're captivated by this Brazilian.
Yes.
It's 85.
Yes.
We've got a Lotus.
Yes.
So fast forward. We can go back into your love of Senna and why you got to that point. But I want to understand where you were in your life. What year it was? Was it 07, 08 around then that you did this?
October 2004.
Was it that early?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, there you go.
Yeah.
So how did you come to be in a position where, and I will go through this later on, Manish is a polymath, he's a qualified doctor. So you're a doctor and suddenly you're going to make a film about Senna. It's a harebrained idea. How did you go about it? How did you persuade everyone to do it?
Okay, so in a nutshell, I actually, 4 years earlier, got my first rom-com commissioned by Working Title Films. So they really liked it. I did another one. They really liked it. The problem was they weren't getting made for various reasons. And what was really cool though was that I'd worked with a head of film for a year and I married her. And that was really rather wonderful.
Ooh, clever.
Exactly. So we're now getting into high stakes nepotism or insider trading in film. So Nat had worked with a producer, James Gayrish. They'd done a zombie movie together, Long Time Dead, I think. And James actually had read in 2004 a series of articles in the Times about the death of Senna. And he thought, oh, wouldn't that make a great documentary?
James.
Gayrish.
Yeah.
And James, through various mechanisms, had a three-picture deal at Working Title. at the time, and he pitched the idea of the death of Senna to Eric Fellner, co-chairman of Working Title. Now, Eric's a big petrol head, and he loved the idea of this, but it was the death of Senna, and my wife said to James, "Oh, you ought to meet my husband, because he is mad about Formula One, he can write, and he really knows about Senna." So I met him, actually, in his office, just upstairs, literally 100 yards from where we're sitting now in October 2004. And he said, you know, and we should call it 3 days at Imola, and it's about this guy, and he arrives, and it's his death. And I listened, and I just said, no, it won't work. And he said, what do you mean it won't work? And I said, it's powerful, but to really understand Senna's death, you had to understand his life. And I then talked to James for an hour about Senna's life, you know, Brazil 91, about being the kid from Brazil and coming out here, about the hardship and everything. And he said, can you get that down? You know, can you write that? And I spent, I think it was a couple of months, working on a 10-page outline. And the structure in filmmaking is actually hasn't changed in 100 years. Three acts, they're kind of approximately a quarter of the way in. You've got to switch.
Yeah.
You then another 50% of the story, then you switch into the third act, and that's how it works. And my first act was actually from the reign in Monaco to him becoming world champion. So we're doing 4 years in a quarter of the time. And everyone was like, well, I mean, aren't we missing lots of stories here? And we're not, because what the story is about, ultimately, is a really good guy in a really bad world, really tough world. He's very pure. That's the thing about him. And it's that classic line from Al Pacino in Godfather 3. Not a good film, but that great line, just when I think I got out, they drag me back in. And that's Formula One. And it was amazing, because what you have when he wins that championship, that's when the target's on his back. That's when it starts to get tough.
Yeah.
And so you have this whole second act, which is going to be about him trying to establish himself as the best. Finally, in my opinion, establishing himself as the best. But like everything else, I mean, this just lives on the edge of a razor blade.
Yeah.
You know, that is how big the edge is. And then bang, you're into Imola. You're into the third act. And I remember a few people saying...
So the outline that you presented was accurate to what you ended up making?
Oh, in the end. I mean, scarily faithful.
So once you... Because I've never been bold enough or brave enough to undertake something like that. So you're there, I've got someone to commission this film. Someone wants to make it.
Yeah.
The outline's been approved. Yeah. And also it's been approved to my design. So I'm happy with the fact that they're going to make the film I want to make.
Yeah.
Then what do you do? You don't have Bernie Eccleston's phone number. You can't just go, right, Bernard... I want access to all this archive. How on earth do you go about it?
So, July, I can even tell you the day, in fact. It's just, this is how insane it all is. June the 23rd, 2005, following year, James had sent a few emails to the Senna Foundation. And just by chance, Bianca Senna and the head of business affairs was going to be in England that day and had some time for some meetings. So we met Bianca and this guy called Celso Lemos. And it's a nice formal meeting, and it was a little bit stiff, but there was something really nice about both of them, I really felt. And I got to talk a little bit, and I think this is just a big lesson in life, actually. You can have whatever personality you have, whatever it is, good, bad, indifferent, personable, non-personable. But there is nothing like having knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay, nothing. Nothing like having knowledge. I just say it again. You know, if you know what you're talking about, it really doesn't matter if you're wearing the wrong sweater.
Because even if the people who are listening to you know they know nothing about it, everyone has an authenticity filter, don't they? They know, he knows his shit.
Correct. Exactly that. So we sat down, I talked to him about it, and then Bianca had other meetings to do, but Celso did have time. So we went to lunch. He asked 1,000 questions at lunch. And it was a... You know, presumably, it really was like a quiet. It felt like a quiet interrogation. And then,
but at this point, how many times do you think they've been approached?
So we found this out. So we actually found this out. So this is 2005. Okay, the original Antonio Banderas Warner Brothers project was 1995. So in those intervening sort of 10 years, he said to us, we were getting 8 offers a year. We're getting an offer every month and a half. And the family were just saying no to everything. And he said to me, it was incredible. He just sort of calmed it like, he said, you need to come out to Brazil. You need to pitch this directly to Viviani. I can make that happen for you. Can I give you a bit of advice? You speak beautifully, but she's audiovisual. You need to bring something visual with you. and I think you'll get this made. He said that, and I remember, you know, James and I looking at each other, thinking, oh, it's unbelievable. It took us till March the 5th, 2006 to get that meeting. You know, stamina is required. And and I remember, I thought, at that time, you really couldn't scrub things off YouTube. There wasn't that much stuff around. So what I actually did was I made a slideshow, and the slideshow was 12 sequences, first act, second act, third act. And my wife, who knows everything, who hot off the success of Billy Elliot, said to me, oh, no, you got this one wrong. And she's always right. And I said, what way is this wrong? She had 5 minutes, 10 minutes maximum. And she said, how long is your thing? And I timed it, and I'd got it beautifully down to 38 minutes. So she was like, they're going to fall asleep. Yeah. And I said, you know what? The other thing I think I share in common slightly with San and Nat is OCD. Like, he would personally pore over every semicolon in his contract. And I just have a feeling the family are like that. So this is one of the few times I think you're wrong. And she said, well, you know, it's your funeral, all the rest of it. So James and I get on the BA jet. It goes 400 yards down the runway. I've never seen anything. The pilot literally stopped the plane and said, we have a problem. 45 minutes later, we're all being turfed off the plane. This meeting has taken 10 months to put together. I have a three-week-old son, and it's 3 a.m. So we're on our mobiles. The plan was to arrive a day before, because no one wants an IT failure when they go and present something like this, especially if it's 38 minutes. And I always have music, you know, a lot of music. And so I go home. We get a call from the airline. The flight is actually, in the end, it was 20 hours delayed. The bottom line is this. It meant that the day I arrived in Brazil at 4 a.m. in the morning, at 10 a.m., we would be meeting the Senna's 6 hours later.
Horror story.
But honestly, just the whole thing was just, oh my God. So we got to the hotel, very ritzy hotel in Sao Paulo. Celso met us, and then first moment.
Celso
Lemos, sorry, was the head of business affairs.
His job was for
the Senna Foundation, and his job was basically to say no in a very charming way
to everyone.
To everyone, that's what he'd been doing, and that's what he did.
Yeah.
Except to us.
Yeah.
So Celso came, picked us up at the hotel, drove us to the Senna family building, the foundation building. It was a building that Senna himself had picked. The top five floors would have his businesses. The helipad was on the top floor. There was one lift that took you, you know, classic, the one lift that takes you right up to the office. So we parked in the underground car park. We came out, and so Celso said, oh my God. And I said, what's wrong? He said, not what's wrong. He said, do you see who that is? It was Senna's dad. And he said, in the last 3 years, I haven't seen him here. He said, that's just when he introduced us. So I got to shake hands with my big hands, big man. Really, I don't know how you would describe his face. He had that face that had seen everything.
Yeah.
You know, and they used to say about him, he had Midas hands. He could take any business and turn it into gold. Yeah. Very formal man, very lovely man, very, you know, very methodical. Anyway, so we shook hands, and I also said, that's a good omen. So we go up. We're going to the small office where I'm going to present. I, of course, plug my computer into the big screen. Nothing I can do. Projects the images on my computer to the big screen, which is why you go the day before. Fortunately, I had taken a pair of speakers, those little things that you used to put an iPod in.
There's a lesson here for anyone that has your presentations.
Absolutely. You got, I mean, you know, sound, music is everything in film, actually. You know, yeah. Everything you don't write and see is the music. And so anyway, so I put it together, and I thought, well, we're going to have to do it on the laptop. Right? You know, at that time, it was a 15-inch laptop. And then Viviani walked in, and I shut my eyes. I can remember exactly what she was wearing. Beautiful dress, and she had some gold earrings, quite long gold earrings. I mean, she just looked like some kind of Inca goddess. I mean, that was just my hero's sister.
Yeah.
All those jeans, just walking in. And I looked into her eyes, and I just thought, this is going to be all right, actually. And normally I get very nervous before these things, and I just suddenly felt incredibly calm. And because, of course, we couldn't show it on a big screen, we had to huddle around my computer around the table. Seven people in the room, including James and me, and I hit play. And the music started, and the first images started, and I started talking, and I knew it well.
And these are just, these are slides, were they?
They're slides. There's no moving image, it's just slides. So I picked these slides very carefully, each act, And each sequence, and she started crying. Straight away, so I hit pause. And I still can't quite believe I said this. I said, please don't cry, because if you cry, I'll cry, and we'll never finish this. So she calmed down. I remember, I hit play, and 40 minutes went by, like, it was 2 minutes.
How quickly did you phone your wife and say, yeah, I told you so?
that text came late. But what I realized when I got to the end, because I'm just looking at this screen, I wasn't looking at anyone else in the room. When I stopped, everyone was crying. And I remember the lawyer, the senior lawyer at Working Title, when James and I went out, said, don't negotiate. All you need to do is get them to some point of interest. Let us sort of get into it. You know, these things take forever to get a decision. Don't worry about it. Viviani got up, gave me a hug, and said, we're making this film with you.
And she could authorize that.
Correct. I stood there, mouth kind of wide open. I looked at James. James looked at me. We couldn't believe it. And then we ended up having a wonderful lunch with them. Well, we had a great dinner alone that evening. And they asked me, is there anything you'd like to do while you're out here? And I said, I'd like to go to Murrumbi. I'd like to see... I actually get a bit emotional about this in a second. When I was a medical student and I was... I found medical school very tough. But one thing I used to have on my desk was... it was that photo film that said, don't crack under pressure.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
And I had a little... I had an MP4-4, a little, well, I think it was a 1/43rd version of it, a tiny thing. They just
mini
sat
champs.
On my desk. Yeah, mini champs one, exactly.
Yeah.
Had them on my desk, and I remember when he died, I just couldn't look at my desk.
Yeah.
And so I'd actually carried this car with me, and I went to Murrumbi Cemetery, and I took it out of my pocket, and I just put it...
Left it there.
Yeah, I thought whether this movie happens or not, you know, some things happen in your life, which I can tell you, forget BAFTAs, forget even making the movie.
Yeah.
Just all of that, it's just, that's all great, all, you know, that's what you do for a living. There are these human experiences that you have sometimes, they are so profound. It's what we were put on earth to do.
Yes, and I think maybe I've made a mistake not allowing not allowing myself, the tissues being passed over, allowing you to tell us your history. But of course, I think people can tell that this is someone who's trained as a doctor and has found themselves 10 years later in a career position that makes no sense whatsoever, talking to the sister of their hero, having just been authorised to make a film about their life. I mean, it's utterly bizarre. You should have been ripping appendixes out, shouldn't you, really?
Yeah, or actually, in my case, putting plates in. Putting plates in. But I think the point is that basic trust is established.
Yeah.
And I think that's another great lesson in life, that, you know, in terms of getting deals done, you hear all this sort of Wall Street nonsense. Actually, I think the best deal-making is very interpersonal, because there's some... We have compasses. I mean, hopefully one has a bit of a brain in that you can read a CV so you know somebody's competent. But after that, you do make fundamentally emotional decisions. They can be really, really wrong, as they have been with FTX, for example.
Yeah.
Okay, or with Bernie Madoff. So, you know, I introduce someone and it. But I think if you do your due diligence, if you make sure somebody's got a decent CV, if they really seem to know what they're doing and enough people vouch for them, I think you can make informed decisions. And it took us a while then to go from there to making a movie. But the next critical step for us was, because Viviana had accepted what we were doing, they called Bernie Eccleston. So they called Bernie. And
so
they
you must be thinking, this is bizarre. So
it's about to get...
Med school, Viviani Senna,
yeah.
Now we're at call Bernie.
Call Bernie. So they called Bernie, and I was taking some proper time off, you know, I guess we now call it paternity leave.
Yeah.
So I was actually in the Caribbean with my wife, my very young son, and I got a call saying, Bernie can meet you on Wednesday. And I was like, but Wednesday, as in 5 days from now, Wednesday? Yes. You don't have to be at the meeting, but I think it'd be useful if you could. So then I had to get a flight back to London. Still slightly surreal, all of this. And went to Princess Gate for the first time in my life, went there, you know, the doors open, very nice receptionist, all those meeting rooms, and we were in, I remember we were in the room that is, they nicknamed it the Playboy room, because you go in, very small room, comparatively, but on the back wall is a Playboy bunny. And then when you get close, you realize it's a painting made up of front covers of Playboys. And they're all about a centimeter and a half by a centimeter. It's like, it's a mosaic of Playboy. Anyway, so sat there, met their head of media rights, had a long chat with him, and then Bernie came in, and I will never, ever forget this as long as I live. And he wore a tie, had a white shirt, black trousers, and he had a tie. He had a black tie on. And he didn't sit down. It was amazing. He didn't sit.
Was he wearing jeans or slacks?
He was wearing black trousers, and they had a very, very sharp crease. And no, I just remember he leant on the back of a chair, sleeped over. We were sitting down. He listened. And there was something about him, I have to say, I just really liked. Just immediately, he walked in. I know what it is. I think he projects. Listen, if you're smart around him, you realize you are facing someone who's 10 times brighter than you, for sure. I get that. And he has got a sense of humor, but there is an energy he has. You know, I'm not getting too Buddhist about this. And I just really liked it. And he asked us a couple of questions about what we want to do, how he could help. And the answer was obviously archive. And you'll remember nobody had made kind of the archive docs before this.
Yeah. I don't think anyone knew what the archive was, did they?
No, so I knew it was in Biggin Hill, and yeah. I knew of it, I just didn't know how extensive. I had no idea what their rights were, you know, what percentage of Tender's life would be Bernie Archive versus something else. And, you know, we were having to guess all of this stuff, but we did talk to him, and I think, again, in a, I think intelligent man, I think going as working title films was massively helpful. I think having the Senna endorsement, because they'd never phoned anyone. They'd never phoned Bernie to say anyone, you know, for anyone else.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say. Massively inarticulate now.
But so you've got there.
Yeah.
Bernie, you've come in with the correct introductions.
Correct.
You've got this little man who's leaning on the back of a chair, who's radiating intelligence, menace, all the things we know he can radiate.
Very much.
And what does he say to you? Does he want to make you feel relaxed? Does he want to just throw you off guard now and again? Does he want to make...
It was exactly that. So he's going, so it's historical. And I said, yes. Is he going to die in it? And I said, yes.
Is he going to die in it?
Yeah.
He kind of did.
But the point is, I think he's obviously asking, what's Bernie... I mean, I've thought about this a million times, and I think, obviously... Yes, it's great, the Viviani vouch for us. That's all very, very good. But I think Bernie wanted to make sure we weren't making some awful, you know, half-assed snuff movie.
Which is the reason why no one had been allowed to do it before.
Correct. And that's the easiest way to do it, by the way. Always, you know, always go for the obvious, you know, big poster angle. And that's not what I was interested in doing. I hope the one thing I do radiate is some integrity in these. You know, there's no way... I'm going to make a film about the death of the person I absolutely most loved as a, you know, as a kid, as a hero of mine. And so I think he got that. But what he did say, and again, I'll never forget, it was genius. As he was leaving, he just stopped, turned around and went, "Give us all the money you've got. We'll see what we can do." And he shook my hand and he was gone. And it was unbelievable.
So what's next steps? What do you do when Bernie Eccleston said, "Give us all your money"?
So then we start to budget this. We start to work out roughly how many minutes of footage we need. And I've got to tell you, I mean, initially, I got this wrong by exactly 50%, because what we thought we might be making was a more conventional feature doc. So we'd have some access to amazing archive, but we thought it might well be Talking Heads.
Yeah.
And I remember it wasn't the end of that. Then we went into stasis because doing the deal with the family was taking a very, very long time. Obviously, they're, you know, the intention is there, but you know, when lawyers get together, things become very formal. If somebody had told me from the moment Bernie had kind of winked and said yes to the moment we actually got going would be another almost 2 years, I would have been looking at things. But you do these things out of love. I mean, you do these because you just get up in the morning and go, "We've got to make it happen, no matter what." And so I think it was about 6 months later, James, I think, had worked with Asif Kapadia in I can't remember whether, maybe in advertising or something, but he knew him. So we met Asif, and he's just the right guy. I don't know if anybody's seen the film The Warrior, which was his first film, won 2 BAFTAs, really should have won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film. It's just beautiful, and it's really what I call filmmaking.
Yeah.
You know, he, what you're supposed to do when you make a movie, it's in the title, make stuff move. And if you can get rid of dialogue, get rid of dialogue. Try to make that, the whole point is you've got the moving camera, make it move. Tell the story in pictures. And he just had it. And I remember we, a friend of mine who is now an unbelievably cool plastic surgeon, he's the only person I know actually who's a plastic surgeon who has a world record in radio hamming. They drop you on an island, you have 24 hours to set up a mast and do Morse code as fast as possible, and it has to be acknowledged by someone else. And you do that solidly for 24 hours, and then the person with the most...
This is a known task that people actually do.
Did people go and do this? This is
radio hamming.
This is what they do. And his name is Marios Nicolaou, and he holds the world record. He's also an unbelievable plastic surgeon. And I remember at the time, he was the only person, our health secretary, Lord Darcy, would allow anywhere near his computer. Because Marios makes the kind of guys who build Saturn V rockets look very, very ordinary. He is so good. So Marios created a little program to rip YouTube clips. So we were ripping YouTube clips, any YouTube clips we could find of Senna, and I was getting my Formula One tapes. I had all of my old tapes, and we were ripping those. So Asif and I decided, we'd got my outline, we refined the outline, and we thought, you know what we got to do? We got to make something moving, because we've got to move this project along. So he and I, we spent basically, I think it was 5 days in my study, cutting an 8.5-minute promo for this. 3 acts, exactly the acts I've said.
Yeah.
Act 1, Senna makes it world champion. Act 2, by the end of it, he finally wins his 3rd championship. Act 3, Imola. We put it together, we added music, one piece from Blade Runner, which I remember, you know, there's no chance in hell you could ever option or buy that. And
Vangelis, wasn't it?
It was Vangelis, exactly. Yeah, it's beautiful. Actually, a piece of music, I was thinking it was called Rachel's Song, which never made the movie. But we put this together, and as we finished this, I'd love to claim this as my idea. It wasn't mine, it's 100% his. He turned around and looked at me and went, oh my God, you know what? And I said, what? He said, we don't need talking heads. We just need to do it like this. And then I just thought, you know, in that moment, you just go, you're not even 80% right. You're 100% right. The only problem is, by now we'd agreed deal terms with Bernie, and it was for 40 minutes of archive. We now needed 80 minutes of archive. And without going into the details of the contract, let's just say that for the 41st minute became punitive. So we went back to see Bernie's lawyer. Now, Bernie wasn't...
Princess Gate again.
Princess Gate, back we go. And went to see them and said, look, we've got much further with this project. This is what we need. He said, so what do you need? We need double the footage.
Who's David Copperfield? You're there with the cap out, aren't you?
I mean, it's just, please, sir, can I have 40 minutes more? Exactly
that. For a man who's notoriously generous when it comes to giving away his IP.
Well, you know what, though? I've gotten him a little bit. As I said, he does take things at face value sometimes. And so I explained this very, very reasonably. Just said, look, we need 40 more minutes of archive. It's not that we won't pay you. What we can't do is go get punitive, but we will pay you the same amount per minute as we do for the first 40. That we can afford. That we can afford, and we can make this with that. Anything else? Yeah, we'd like to come to the archive. And I just got this look, and you want to come to Biggin Hill? Yes. Well, what do you want to do there? Look at the tapes. How long are you thinking about? 2, 3, 4 hours? 4 weeks. 4 weeks? How many of you? It would definitely be 2 of us, up to 4. We need viewing stations. It's like, I will put all of this to Mr. Eccleston, but I think you should prepare yourself for the worst. You're not going to believe this. The next day, it was yes. Yes, for everything. And I just remember thinking, this is now, we're well into the realms of this project. It's got its own life. It's going to happen. It's going to be beautiful. You just know. There's a moment where you just know. And we went, and it was great. We got charged for the sandwiches, by the way, which I thought was genius. So it was, I think it was like £5.60 per person. So we were getting charged up to £22 a day, you know, for these.
And it's a very private area for him, isn't it? Biggin Hill is his man cave.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's where the cars are. Yeah. No one gets access to that.
No. And Bernie made a decision. You know, he knew we weren't joking, and he knew we weren't mucking around. And what I think is really rather wonderful about this is that, you know, it was a stuff in that time. What you can search is limited, of course. But you're being intelligent with your searching, and I give 10 out of 10 to everything I see. Asif's got much more discriminating eyes, or certainly had then. He'd go, look, come on, it's just more racing. We need something a bit more. He was very good in that way. But there was one thing that I remember I found, and I was just completely like, oh my giddy aunt, whoa. And it's when Donnelly has his accident. I found the shots of Senna in
first
the garage.
Scene,
no, but it was Senna in the garage seeing it on his monitor.
Oh, get the, I remember that.
Yeah, it's a killer moment because he has tears in his eyes. And then you see the car coming out because he decides he's going to qualify. And found the shot of the car pulling up just to the edge of the pit lane so he could be the first out afterwards. And it just, I remember seeing that and feeling kind of like, oh my word. And you can see it's that, this isn't me picking an actor and putting him in the right outfit and telling him to act. This is real, and you've got such a lot of responsibility.
So as someone who, see this. Who probably, I have what I have in common with many of our listeners is that I'm not a filmmaker, I've been involved in television a while. But what is it, why is it Senna looks so beautiful, and where did you find this footage? Because what stunned me was, I was used to seeing Formula One viewed through a long lens with no depth of field, that was a sports camera, you know, that films Wimbledon, cricket. And suddenly I saw Formula One in a different way. I saw depth of field, I saw lensy shots. Where the hell did this stuff come from?
So this is the thing about Bernie, is he really, I think people really don't understand him. And I think the thing is, he wanted to make this a televisual sport. He was filming all that behind the scenes stuff and paying for his own crew to do it. Been doing it from the mid 80s. They had all of this. All of this B-roll that never went out except on minorly on these highlights tapes at the end of the year, because I think it was one of those things where they had enough crew. Think about it like this. Supposing you need one cameraman at every corner on a 12-corner circuit, okay, plus a bit of extra coverage. So say you've got 16 cameramen, okay, but what are they supposed to do in between practice sessions?
Exactly.
And Bernie doesn't waste a thing. That's the thing about him.
So he was saying, get out there.
Correct. Somebody, well, it wouldn't have been Bernie, I can tell you it would have been Eddie Baker.
Yeah.
Eddie Baker ran all of that for him, and he would have been saying, listen, we've just flown all of these people out. They've all got a camera. Come on, film something. Have a bit of fun. Do some long lens stuff. One of the shots that we saw so many versions of is you would have a tire between you and your subject, and what they would do is they would get the lens to go and shoot through the bolt hole of the tire. So you shoot someone and then you just pull the focus and you back on the tire.
Yeah.
And they would try all kinds of things, and that's exactly what they were doing, and this was all there.
But did you know it was there?
No.
So the moment you suddenly realised, hang on a minute, someone's actually shot.
Well, you have
someone's already shot the movie of Formula One.
Correct.
But no one told us.
Exactly. But I mean, there were hints of it, because if you look at all of those tapes, the first Fokker tape came out in 1980, you know, the kind of completed Fokker tape. And the last one that I'd seen up to then was obviously 94. There was behind-the-scenes stuff in it. You know, there were voiceovers. And
but you probably didn't acknowledge it.
Correct. Except when we were making that 8.5-minute thing, I think that was why it was so inductive, because suddenly Asif, with his filmmaker's hat on, went, hold on, there's tons of coverage in the B-roll. It's just there. That looks like a movie rush to me.
But wasn't it also the case that because Bernie was the first person to understand how you might ring fence an event, he owned the IP for what everyone else was producing at the weekend as
absolutely
well?
Absolutely right.
The case?
Absolutely right. If you shoot something with a moving camera within 300 metres of a Formula One circuit from the Thursday before to the Monday afterwards, it's owned by...
He's a genius.
He is a genius. He understands rights.
Yeah.
But he also... I think he gets a bit of storytelling. He gets narrative. And so... We were there, we did this, we started putting this together, and you could feel this was going to be special. And the last ingredient, to be honest, and it's something that really shouldn't be understated, was I think James got the call from Antonio Pinto in Brazil saying, I am writing the music for this. And we're like, who are you? I am a Brazilian composer, I've done some movies with Walter Salles, he'd done a few things, and he sent us three tracks. I played the first one again, just lots of tears, just burst into tears. It was Senna, the theme, that lonely trumpet sitting on top of this orchestra that just builds and builds and builds. And suddenly we've got this composer who is making the most beautiful music, and it just came together. I'm not saying it was easy, and we got so much stuff wrong, And you would watch it, and there were always issues of pacing, and you could see a lovely sequence and then go, oh, I'm a bit bored now getting from there to there. And, you know, obviously with my motor racing hat on, you know, Asif was probably getting migraines, going, oh, Matt keeps telling me to put a race in. This race is a terrible idea. And of course, you know, in the end, of course, you back down. But that basic essence, that structure never changed. And in fact, what I did was I created a script using, and that's why people say, well, how do you write a documentary? What I did was I literally went through all the books, and I got my final draft out, and I wrote it as a script. And what I would do is, if it existed as a book, it would be blue. If it existed on film, so I had seen a rush, I would write it in black.
Yeah.
So I would write Senna walks down pit lane like that in black, and then I would write the dialogue. The tough bit was I would have this magenta, which is, this is our dream if we can find it. So you know, so you're kind of informing yourself, and it was way too long. In fact, I still got a couple of copies of it.
So what? For example, with some of the footage, the bits that I think really struck many petrolhead and motorsport enthusiasts was him as a young man talking about, and also talking about Fulhamore, and it was Fulhamore, wasn't it? The kart racer.
Fullerton.
This was real racing. Yeah. I mean, it was almost like he'd written his Mojus for this film to be written about his life 30 years later, what it was. That was the crazy thing, wasn't it?
Well, can I just say, I mean, that was another piece of inductive brilliance from Asif, actually, that. So what happened was we got to the end of the story, and that's actually from the Australian Grand Prix in 1993. Senna's about to leave McLaren to go on his new adventure. And he's asked by, if you listen, it's like, I've forgotten his name, it's an Australian journalist, who his greatest rival was. That's the same journalist, by the way, who calls out Prost in that first accident. I put it to you, you turned in early. You know, he says that. You think I would do something like this on purpose? You know, the same journalist. And there was this absolute moment of sort of shock when Senna doesn't say, oh, it was Schumacher, oh, it was Prost, oh, it was actually Mika. No, it was the guy he didn't beat. It was the guy he didn't beat, the older man. The
first,
one who was
first
just
girlfriend
better.
Complex, though, isn't it? First girlfriend complex.
It's a beautiful moment, and I remember. But it really mattered to Asif. And I'll tell you the clever bit. I mean, if that's not clever enough, we had this lovely footage that was Super 8 in colour. Weren't sure what to do with it except to stick it at the front. And of course, he said, "Let's stick it at the back," and then now let's add Fullerton to this. And you see him, and you realise how simple. And this story is about ultimately that quest. You know, heaven on earth can exist, but it's simple. And I think people lose that. And that was all he wanted. He just wanted a steering wheel. He didn't even want a gearbox. He wanted a steering wheel, a brake, and an accelerator. For him, those three inputs, that's everything. There is nothing else after that. That is the beauty. You can't hide behind it. You can't hide behind aero. Can't hide behind the size of the engine. It's just me drawing better lines than you. Repeatedly getting into a rhythm where there's this precision, and that's who he was.
The description of the Monaco lap was always fascinating, wasn't it? The idea that he goes to this almost superhuman state, he can't remember what's going on, he's clearly holding his breath. There's so much shit that's wrong about that, by the way. It was technically dangerous.
I've got another absolutely it had to be story about this. So Jerry Donaldson, a Canadian reporter, had done that interview with him, and I assumed, like all of these reporters, he's going to have his tape. So we met him for lunch, and he said, oh gosh, sorry, in those days, our TDK C90s, you know, I was a working journalist, we fly economy everywhere, you think we keep our tapes recorded over, my friend? And I remember that was actually one of the most crushing moments I've ever had, because I just thought, no, that just can't be right. And then we debated, should we get an actor? And that just goes against the ethos then of the whole making of the film. And why would you get an actor to do that? It exists. Yeah. You won't believe this. 4 months later, I get a call, and it's Jerry Donaldson. He said, Manish, you're not going to believe this. We're selling our house in Canada, and my cleaning lady's just gone through the loft. She's found the tape. I said, what? She's found the tape. I've got the tape in my hands. And I said, don't move. I'm going to send a bike over now. We will just take the tape. We'll record the tape. I'm going to burn it onto some CDs, as we did then, because they weren't memory drives. And I will get a transcript done of the whole tape, and I will return the whole tape to you, okay? But please let us option the rights to this. And when you see that Monaco lap, which unfortunately isn't 88, there wasn't an onboard camera at the time. We cheated it from 2 years later.
Yeah.
But when you see that lap, to Senna's voice, not an actor's voice. It just, that was the point of the film. That's the point. That's the whole point. You're in the car with him, feeling what he feels, experiencing what he, you know, experienced in that moment.
I think part of the reason why the it worked on so many levels, why it resonated, was we got, and I have to be very careful, I don't come across as an arse here, we knew he was a magician behind the wheel, and we also knew that he was a complicated human being. But because we were living mostly in a magazine era and also in a television era, we didn't know much about Senna other than what we read in the papers. What we didn't know was that he was a poet with words as well. And there's also something very rhythmic about the way he talks in the film, isn't there? The cadence of the way he talks draws you in. It's magnetic. I remember thinking, I want to hear him talk more about this subject, because he romanticizes it in a way that doesn't come across as sticky or treacly. He's not doing it to make us think he's a god or better. I'm just drawn in because I think this might be the greatest exponent of this art that I've ever heard or seen.
I mean, I can't put it better than that. It just, that's the point. When he spoke, there was a hush in those press conferences. And he wasn't, like Bernie, not a loudly spoken man, very quietly spoken. And you had to lean forward to listen. But it was so introspective, so precise. He would think about it. We've got to remember, he's not even speaking English to us. You know, he's not speaking English as his first language, you know. So he's sitting there very often. There's a beautiful moment, actually. Again, it was after the Donnelly accident where they ask him, you know, how he's doing. And he there's a pause. And some people said that what he would do is sometimes take the English or Italian, because he speaks Italian, and translate it into Portuguese, come up with his answer and then say it to you in English. And that's why there's a little lag sometimes with him. And what you realize is it's this quest for perfection was kind of in everything, you know, really OCD. And you should listen to Bianca describe it, because, you know, Bianca and I are now really good friends. I'm very close to the family, you know. We've never lost that contact. It's a lovely thing. And she described him once in the morning just slightly losing himself at breakfast. You're not going to believe this, just putting some butter on some toast and trying to get an absolutely even layer of butter onto this piece of land. I thought,
then realizing people were watching it.
Suddenly he did kind of, you know, snap out of it. But she said, they went, what are you doing? And he went, oh, sorry, yeah, it's cold now. You know, but there is something about a personality like that. And when they put that level of, you know, it's that word he used repeatedly, dedication. It's a beautiful word, I think. When you have that level of dedication to this thing that you do, you know, how can it not be absolutely beautiful?
So Bernie has given you access to the Total Archive, and you've asked for 4 weeks. Is your dealings with Bernie done at that point?
No, so what's great is we do it. We pay them, you know, which I think he liked. Then what happened was the three really lovely beats now with Bernie after this. When we got to the point where we could show the movie, we gave the office a call. Bernie's lawyer, Bernie's media rights person, another one of Bernie's lawyers, actually, I remember, two came, and Fabiana came to see the film. So they came to Working Title.
He's been Fabiana to the...
Sorry, so Fabiana, Bernie had... Fabiana and Bernie weren't married at the time. He just had a divorce a couple of years earlier.
Yeah.
And he'd been with Fabiana, I think, for about a year at that point. And Fabiana's Brazilian.
Yeah.
And Fabiana's a Paulista. And so, you know, she's very steeped in the art of Senna. And she was actually on the FIA. She used to work, in fact, not the FIA at the time. She used to work for the promoter of the Brazilian Grand Prix.
Right.
And he was actually the person who introduced Bernie to Fabiana. So she's not somebody who doesn't know about motor racing. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So the four of them sat with us and they watched a film and they loved it. They really loved it. And what was lovely was...
How close was that to the finished product that we saw?
Oh. Basically the
it
same
was the
film.
Film.
Yeah, it was a film. And, you know, bits to do with the colour, bits to do with sound, blah, blah, blah. But it was a film. And I think what they were actually a little bit blown away, because I think they expected to go in and see quite a sort of dry dock. And they came out thinking, oh my God, I've just seen a film in the afternoon. It felt like a film. That's the point. It feels like a film. And, you know, again, you just can't stress, I think, Asif's instincts in this enough. He was not thinking about this as a documentary, not at all. Thought about this as a feature, all the way through. It was great learning for me because you can write and you can do this. But when you see that transcription, you know, you learn vertically. And so they loved it. After that, Bernie came to the premiere. He said he would, and he did. And there were two beautiful moments about the premiere. One thing that I did, which no doubt is completely illegal, I invited Murray Walker, and I got a call from some moron in the accounts office of wherever saying, well, how's he going to get up here? Turns out he lives in Hampshire, and you know, it's going to be very expensive. And we're going to send him a car because he's 80 something. No, we're not. We're not going to send him a car. I mean, that's going to cost us, I don't know, it was like 600 quid or something. I said, this is Murray Walker.
Yeah.
So I actually contacted someone who was working on a much higher budget film at Universal. I said, would you get a car for Murray Walker? And can we charge it to your film? They said, yes, we can.
Right. He's Murray Walker.
That's Murray Walker. So we got Murray to come up in a car. And I remember came out of the cinema, and I saw Bernie. He said, come here. And I was just walking to Murray to Bernie, and this black Mercedes came by, and the back window came down, and Murray.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Wave designer went, Manish, thank you. I was on a cloud.
Yeah.
Murray Walker, thank me. You know, he said that was him. What a great movie. And off he went. And then Bernie said, come here. He gave me a hug. And I remember thinking, oh, that's unusual. And I think, I can't remember who it was. It was a motorsports journalist who knew him. Said, doesn't do that very often. You know, you've done all right, I think. I think you can probably ask for a pass. I think he'll probably give you one. And we never got out of touch, actually, after that. You know, Bernie famously doesn't email, but you can email his assistants. He famously reads everything. And if you phone him, he picks up the phone. You know, he's that kind of human being. You know,
very well, that segues into...
Well, wait, just
the last thing as well.
The last part of this is my absolute favourite. So, we had the BAFTAs. We won. We won two.
And that's unheard of for a film of that type.
Yeah, a documentary about motor racing wins best editing and best documentary. It was an amazing feeling. So it was my son's birthday that day. He was going to be six. And he had a meltdown as we were leaving because you have to leave early. And you know, I hope you lose daddy. And I mean, the whole thing. My wife brilliantly had kept Harry Potter 4 behind and said, here you go. And went, okay. Like that, and he calmed down. And I stupidly bribed him. I said, listen, tomorrow I'm going to buy you any Lego you want. Okay? And the next day, I was...
Four is Phoenix.
I was... Yes, exactly.
Right,
so
sorry, carry on.
I was... very good. So I was very, very hungover, as you can imagine, the next day. Very tired. And like a clock, at 5 o'clock, he said, right, Daddy, let's go and get our Lego. So I just couldn't believe he held me to this. Dumb me. So we drove to Brent Cross to Toys R Us. I don't know if you've been there on a cold February day, February 13th, 2012. And there are just basically zombies with onesies pushing plastic around and in these massive... Anyway, so he found this bit of Lego and we were walking to the till and my phone rang. And it was Bernie's assistant saying, oh, hello, is that Mr. Pandy? And I went, yep, because Mr. Eccleston would like a word with you. And I said... Okay, so we were in Toys R Us.
Are you thinking, what have I done?
Well, yeah, I know, I totally, like yeah. Something, oh, something, did I say something stupid? Yes, something. Anyway, Manish, just want to say congratulations. We're all very proud of you. And I thought, oh my God, Bernie Eccleston just said that. And I said, thank you very much. He said, that's all I want to say. I said, okay. Then he said, what's that music in the background? And I said, I could explain this to you. It's complicated. And he said, I've got time. Like that. He's so quick. So I said, I'm in Toys R Us in Brent Cross. And then I explained the story of my son. He goes, have you bought the Lego yet? And I said, no. He said, put it back on the shelf. I said, what? And he said, put the Lego back on the shelf because you'll spoil him if you buy him this. And I said, Bernie, I am not taking, I'll take loads of advice from you. I am not ripping this Lego out of my son's hand, putting it back. Like, let's go home because he's going to teach you a lesson about business in 30 years, right? So he laughed. I was laughing. We were queuing up. And that really was that really happened. It was hilarious. And I was sitting there thinking, God, okay, you know, something's happened.
So you've made this connection with Mr. Eccleston.
Mm.
That's a long time ago.
Mm.
And the reason why we're here is because you have just made an 8 1-hour docupedia of Bernie Eccleston's life in conjunction with him. And this is the key thing.
Mm.
It's not just authorised. He's in it.
Mm.
So how on earth did you manage to make this happen? And just, you can't give it away. I'm going to go for screening in a minute and see the first two episodes, so I feel very privileged. I'm fascinated by this. He's a divisive character. I'm not going to try and wash away some of the controversial things he said or the way he's offended some people. That's just life. He's a man of his age and generation. But what's undeniable is he turned a bunch of Garage Easter into box office, and he created an empire, and I think that's the story we all want to hear. And you've told it. So do you feel worn out, eviscerated by the whole thing, or do you just sit back and think, shit, I've made this with Bernie Eccleston, and I've got his mobile phone number. So what do you think?
Yeah, but I mean, I think a bit of both, to be honest. I mean, I'd always stayed in touch, and I can tell you the day again. I'm good at dates. October the 8th, 2019. It was a Tuesday, 11 o'clock. I went to see him.
Your brain's odd, boss.
It is not normal, that's for sure.
Wow.
But it was very nice. They set up a meeting. You've got to remember, the longest meeting I'd ever had with him up to then was maybe 30 minutes. And I went in, I sat down, he came, he sat down, and I said, like, I'm just going to come straight to the point. I want to make a series about you. And he looked at me and he said, what about me? And I said, I think you've got to tell us the story of F1. That's obviously a very intricate story. It's a story about you as much as it is a story about the sport. I mean, we're talking about all the great drivers, you know, all the great moments, but also all the deals. You've got to talk to us about how you did this.
But knowing who he is, what he's done, and also some of his, what you might call, methods. Did you not think that when you asked that question, it was inconceivable you'd get a truthful answer?
You know what? I thought he'd just say yes or no.
Yeah.
Because I think, I sort of knew him enough, I think, at that point to ask that question, I think. And, I mean, I should just mention, there was a 3-year detour in my life where, straight after Senna, I tried to get a Ferrari film made. The feature. It was set in 57 and 58. I think we got very close a couple of times. Actually, Michael Mann has just made that film.
I know, so you must be spitting tacks.
No, I mean, you know, it was Michael's project. I mean, look, come on, me versus Michael Mann, who knows, right? I mean, yeah. But it's pretty obvious who's going to win that fight. But we got close, you know, we got very, very close. And one of the people who helped me enormously was Bernie. Bernie actually owns most of those Formula One cars from 57 and 58, and they all run. And that's why I went to see him about it originally. But it got to the point where he walked halfway down the Abu Dhabi pit lane to talk to Piero Ferrari for me. He picked up the phone to Sergio Marchionne and said, you should do this. And he put me in Luca Montezemolo's office. Okay, so this is not somebody who didn't have a little bit of faith in me being able to get this done.
And in fairness, it backs up this sort of empirical creature that we know. He's someone who's he's very intelligent, but he just deals in what he can see. And what he's seen is a great film, i.e., if he could do that,
correct,
he could do the next one. He's the man for the job.
Correct, correct. Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. And I think he's, in that way, you know, and this is a man who meets people, you know, in his career. I've been trying to guesstimate, I mean, but I would say he's a man who meets at the very, very top level probably 12 people a week. Okay, and he's been doing this day in, day out since 1950. Okay, and so, you know, his data bank is big and he's very bright, and it becomes pattern recognition for someone like that. They can tell by the way you walk, the way you stand, the way you speak, cross-referencing a couple of clever questions, asking around about you. They can, you know, he doesn't need to do a credit check on you. He can do that with his eyes. He literally can, you know, and I sort of admire that. And I really admire someone who keeps their word. As a doctor, in a way, that's the one thing you're really supposed to do. You're supposed to say, I'll do my best, and you're supposed to do your best.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what you're supposed to do. And that it's always struck me that that's who he is. He just treats as he finds. He really does. You don't want to fight with him.
But he is controversial.
He is controversial.
And we'll come on to that in a minute, because I think that's your view on that is really interesting.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, there might be method behind some of the madness. We can discuss that in a minute. But the idea that he's even agreed to this, I find amazing.
Well, what was amazing was he looked at me and he does this thing, and I've now got to know it a bit, having worked. I've spent 8 weeks with him in the last 2 years, you know, a long time. And I can see there are some things, and he has the most incredible brain. I mean, Professor Sid Watkins used to tell me that man has got an extra lobe, right? He really has, trust me. You know, Prof was no dummy. I mean, he was super bright. And he just said, no, I don't think, Bernie, wait till you get to know him a bit. I mean, he is just the next level. You know, I went to Cambridge. I spent time with some really serious mathematicians, people who had to take marijuana to slow their brains down enough so that they could string a sentence together, but who could literally do string theory in their sleep, you know, and get this, okay? Half his brain is what I call an unbelievably well-developed bookie brain.
Yeah.
Instant calculation of odds. And the other side is unbelievably incisive when it comes to people, and somehow these two things communicate. In fact, I got invited to a very, very ritzy dinner 4 months ago in Florence, 5 months ago in Florence. I can't tell you who was at that, but there were two Italian people, a husband and a wife. This husband said to his wife, darling, who is the most intelligent person you ever met in your life? And she went, Bernie Ecclestone, right there. Bang. Yeah, bang. And I sat there and I just thought, wow, okay, a lot of people vouch for this, but he's beyond bright, okay? Don't be fooled by age or anything. I mean, he's just bright. He just sees things in the TARDIS way. So he did this thing. He looked at me.
Yeah.
I asked him, would you do it? He looked at me and you could see he was doing a calculation. And what Bernie understands is when he says yes to something, he's actually saying no to something else. He understands the world is a closed system. So all these people who say yes to everybody are actually liars, because they're saying no to loads of other people. You can't say yes twice to the same thing. And I could see him doing a calculation, and he didn't ask me a question, actually. He said one thing, and let's hope this is borne out. He said, if you do it, it'll be very good, won't it? And I said, yes, it will. And he said, okay, let's do it. And he shook my hands. And when he shakes your hands, it's done. Now, you may have to wait a while. There may be all kinds of things that you've got to negotiate between then and now, but it will happen.
So I wouldn't say I'm obsessive on the subject, but I think I've read all the books that people would be brave enough to write about him. I remember there was one that was published, I think, in 02 or 03 called Bernie's Game.
Correct.
I don't know who the author was.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, this struck me as it's still the most interesting one, because it's a book of two halves. In my view, there's the book before the lawyers have got a hold of him and the book after the lawyers have got a hold of him. And
this is the Lovell book.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's almost, it reads like two different people have written it. And I just think, how do you ask the questions that you think no one's been brave enough to ask? Or do you just not ask them because it doesn't matter to the story? How did you approach that side of it?
Just ask him. You know, it was really, really clear, because I said to him, I think what you're going to understand is that what you've done in your life is so far beyond anything we can get into 8 hours. I think you should feel pretty fearless about this. You know, what is he, to be honest, what does he have to fear?
Yeah.
You know, he's 92. He has done it all, been there,
Maybe it's not about what does he have to fear. The question I'm asking is, he appears to have, to ordinary people like myself, he had a very carefully crafted image of the quiet little autocratic dictator that managed to have a bunch of ego-ridden lunatics that would not be told what to do. He could tell them what to do. That was the thing. He was the ringmaster. He could tell Senna what to do. He could tell Michael Schumacher to shut up. No one else could. And I think when you've got that vision, I'm thinking, why would he want to explode that when he's 91 years old? Why change that? Why let us have a peek behind the curtain? Because that might almost alter that view we have of him.
You see, I think that we may have had this view of him from the outside, but I think he worked in a circus where everyone saw him every 2 weeks. Actually, he spent a lot of time with lots of people. And what you've just said is not really what anyone else ever said about him who knew him.
Exactly.
And I think that's the point. I think that should I give you the fundamental reason why, in my opinion, he said yes?
Why?
Should I tell you why he said yes? I would love to tell you it's because I'm a genius. I would love to tell you it's because I was going to... No stone was going to remain unturned, you know? I'd love to tell you that. I'd love to tell you I'm the most sycophantic filmmaker in the world with a big wad of cash sitting underneath my pillow. You know why he did this? He did this for his son. This is why he did this, in my opinion. And I think it's a wonderful thing to do because I, you know, Ace, I've got to know him a little bit. Super clever, so cute, you know? And he's just a little boy. He's a clever little boy. And Bernie's 92.
Yeah.
And I think for, you know, without sentimentalizing this too much, I think Bernie knows he's extremely unlikely to see Ace married. He's extremely unlikely to see Ace through his GCSEs, right? And I think if someone's going to tell Daddy's story, why not take somebody who you know doesn't bullshit, is very passionate, you know, and who will try to get to the bottom of stories rather than taking them at some form of tabloid value. Because if that's what I wanted to do, I'd try to be Piers Morgan then. Why not be the best tabloid editor in the world? If that's what you're going to do, go and do it. That's not really what I've wanted to do with my life, you know?
Did Bernie have full veto?
No. He signed his release almost immediately. He said, you decide what you want to do with this. No veto at all. None. Looking you in the eyes. None.
That's quite scary.
It was scary. Don't get me wrong. I mean, sometimes when you see it, right, there were moments when I was making this, I suddenly thought, oh my gosh, who am I sitting with here? It's Bernie Ecclestone. Pinch yourself. But the thing is that he's led this life that is extraordinary. He's met everyone. It's the breadth of it. And I'll tell you, okay, so invert it. One of the things that, in my opinion, is really weird about Formula One is because the circus arrives at a capital city every 2 weeks or wherever, it draws the people from that city to the circus. Sometimes the people in the circus make the fundamental mistake of thinking that they are very important because of the people who come to the circus. And Bernie's someone who's always had absolute perspective over that. He can't stand people who prance, who are prima donnas, but he loves people who do their work well. He loves that.
Yeah.
He really admires that. And I admire that too. Now, we want to get into kind of levels of controversy. You know, I've got to know him as a man. I've got to, yes, you know, this man was born on October the 28th, 1930. What views do you expect someone like this to have about a lot of the things that now, you know, I hope my children will be, or my son will be fantastically even about. You know, do I want my son to have a homophobic bone in his body? No. Do I think Bernie does? No. Absolutely not. I found him zero sexist, definitely zero racist, and definitely zero homophobic. There's no doubt about it. But he's got this very old-fashioned sense of honor. And I'll give you my interpretation of Putin, for example. Bernie was a used car salesman. Now, people think a used car salesman somewhere where a person goes and buys a car from him. No, he didn't really do that. This is business to business. He bought cars from very, very sharp used car salesmen. And he sold cars to very, very sharp used car salesmen. And the speed at which they conducted their deals would normally mean it's a cash business and you would shake hands and you reconcile at the end of the day. There has to be honor there. Okay? And this is how it works. And there is a lovely old phrase that these boys used to use. What was that guy like to deal with? Take a bullet for him.
Yeah.
Okay, now transpose that to the world in which we live. And people say, he says, I'll take a bullet for Vladimir Putin. He means, comma, in the context of doing a deal. Because he has spent so many, he tells a story, we didn't include it in the series, because the story, basically because we couldn't find the archive of him, but members of the Perón government came up to Bernie in 1974 when Carlos Reutemann runs out of fuel a couple of laps from the end of the race and say, what do you need to make your team successful? So they start talking about money and they promise loads and loads of money and the money never comes. Okay, that's a top politician who promises a team, not a circuit, not to, you know, build a brand new track somewhere, just makes a simple promise in 1974, which is never honored. And it's about a crummy amount of sponsorship on side of the car. Years later, by the way, I am no fan of Putin. I think, actually, you want to see who Putin is, go and get onto the internet now, go and see the speech that he makes to the widows, to the mothers.
Oh, with the cake.
No. Watch what happens, the Kursk submarine disaster.
Yes, sorry, that one.
Right? Yeah. He's in an auditorium, and he's explaining why, the ship's gone down, and one mother becomes hysterical, stands up, they bundle her out. You see a bloke with a syringe, a hypodermic syringe in his hands. They obviously sedated that poor woman before she came. I've never seen anything that scary in my life. Okay, so I'm no fan of Putin's, but let's look at where Formula One used to be, shall we?
Yeah.
Brazil, was it a military dictatorship then? Yep. Argentina, ditto. Oh, South Africa, lovely cuddly place in the 70s and 80s, wasn't it? They went and raced where they could get the money. That's the bottom line.
It was the bottom line.
Welcome to the world in the 70s and 80s and when people weren't fat because they couldn't eat. Okay, this is how people worked. Did he want to make loads of money? Yes, he did. Did he deal with some unsavory people at the time? Yes, he did. Did they come home to dinner at his home? No, they didn't. You know, and this is
Is there any, I mean, I don't want to give it away.
No.
8 hours to go it. But I'm one of the things I'm fascinated to see unfold will there be any sense of regret? Or will he use this as a way to sort of perform catharsis? Because you can look back on his life, and the really naughty bit of me hopes he doesn't, because
he
that,
doesn't.
Yeah, you know, because that will add to his authenticity.
People expect him to be an apologist for himself, and he's not. You know, he's fully formed. I think he's one of these people. He was fully formed at about 15. Okay, he's just that far ahead of the curve, and he's got a very old-fashioned sense of honor. He's got a very, very old-fashioned sense of justice. If you shake his hands, he expects you to deliver. If you don't, you don't get a second chance. That's it.
Yeah.
Because he's a busy man. Okay? And that's what it is. I mean, I look at sort of the Lewis Hamilton trajectory, which I find a shame, to be honest, right? But the world is a very complicated world, and I think there was no issue between them. There was no problem. There was no problem there at all until BLM happened. And I think a lot of people of that generation are very suspicious of movements. You know, he just looks at it. I mean, you know, I can tell you now that, you know, other people I know who are kind of in their 70s and 80s looked at that whole period and just thought, is this being hijacked? What is the real political point being made here? Is it as simple as it looks? And by the way, I think they're wrong. I think it is pretty obvious. I don't think you're allowed to put your knee on any human being until he dies. You know, you can't do that.
Yeah.
Okay, you can't film that. You can't get away with that. It's wrong. And we should be out there. You know, we should be out there with placards. My politics and Bernie's are completely different. But do I believe that fundamentally he has a system of honor, a code of conduct? Yes. And the people who say he doesn't are really interesting because they're usually people who've come out worse than they deal with him.
Yeah, there's a consistency
and
there, isn't
there? There is a real consistency there. And it's one of these things where, and I also think sometimes maybe the thing is in life, very successful people, what happens is people around them feel that they're owed something. And when they're not given what they feel they're owed.
Snipe.
Yeah, and I think, look, I'm not an apologist for anything, but I think he's an extraordinary man. He created a sport, galvanized a sport, where people were dying. Basically, episode one, 5 people die. Jeez. In episode one, okay? This is a sport where it just, you know, it wasn't a sport. It was a demolition derby that started at whatever o'clock, whenever the organizers could be asked to get it going. You know, was there a flag marshal? Who knows, you know? And he saw what it could be. Now, did he do it for purely altruistic reasons? I doubt it. But did he leave the sport? Did he create the sport that I fell in love with? 100%.
Yeah.
You know, did he do his best? Another sort of, you know, morally, you can take this any way you want. John Hogan. John Hogan was the man who worked for Philip Morris.
Yes.
For Marlboro Cigarettes. They put a lot of money into Formula One. Now, I'm a doctor. I don't smoke. I think it's the most evil habit on earth, okay? Marlboro happened to sponsor my superhero. That's pretty inconvenient, isn't it?
Yeah.
Damon Hill, what does he say to me sometimes for having dinner? He goes, you know, one of the strange things, I wake up in the morning as a non-smoker and I go, I was put through school and so are my kids by cigarette companies. What does Sebastian Vettel say on Question Time? He's asked, are you a hypocrite? He said, yes, I am. You know, we find ourselves in morally really difficult places in life. And someone has to create the rules, the framework, whatever you want to call it, and sort of, you know, navigate through that, sometimes for other people. And I think Bernie, you know, was very, very good at doing that. And I remember John Hogan, he came to see us the first week that I filmed Bernie in Switzerland. And you'll see the series. It's a very direct style. There's no hiding it in the way that we put it together. And John said, he won't talk to you about 2 things. And I said, go on. And he said, he won't talk about his own role in safety. He never will. You watch. And he never did.
Yeah.
No matter how much I tried to provoke him, he never would. He would find some reason not to answer the question or skirt it because he didn't want the credit.
Yeah.
And he won't talk about the charities he supported. Never. Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible because those things are unspoken. And but that's his code of conduct.
But is that, I suppose, as someone who's fascinated by him, is that because he genuinely doesn't want the credit or he doesn't want to reveal a level of altruism that might... that might some way damage the image of the dictator?
No, I think it's the former. Yeah. I just think that there are some, you know, it's that thing, you know, charity is something you should do silently, you should not go around telling people I gave it to what.
And there are so many stories of his charity closer to home when mechanics would have ill relatives and suddenly a jet would get them back. I mean, there's been so many of those, they can't be a coincidence.
No, he's, look, I'm just telling you what I found. I found a very, very bright man. He's actually extremely shy. That's the actual truth of it. Like loads of intelligent people, they're just the smartest people in the room.
Well, I posted on Instagram my the cover of the piece and also that clip with him being the director of everyone's lives, which I loved, the animated one. And the comments we got back were interesting. A lot of people saying, I'm looking forward to this, saying, it's managed, he did, Senate, it's going to be fucking great. I love that. But there was lots of negativity, and I think what I want to say to those people is, you don't have to like someone or align yourself with their moral code to be fascinated by them. And I'll let you into a secret here. I hate crabs, not the type that might climb on the human body, the crustacea. I am terrified of crabs. I mean, I really am. But I can't stop watching videos of them on YouTube because it's something that's abhorrent to me, but it's fascinating. And I don't think we should be ashamed as human beings. It's all part of our education of life. So I don't. There are bits of Bernie that I probably find less palatable than you might. But actually, fundamentally, I want to know how he did it. That's the thing. And this is the closest we're going to come to it, I think.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the bottom line with him is it's always understated. But if you understate the same point several times, I think people start to get the point, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I've tried to tackle this. So very often it's not explicit, but I think you'll find the archive around what you're seeing will answer the question if he doesn't directly. And what you see is a very human... What you see is a very, very, very human journey. And I don't know if you remember, there was a great phrase that that was used in a very sarcastic manner around how the American reporters would embed themselves with the US armed forces during the first stages of the Iraq War, the British reporters came up with a phrase, and I think I'll get accused of this. They weren't embedded, they were embuggered.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And loads of people are going to say this. Go, you know, you just, yeah. We've heard it. I'd like to think I'm a bit brighter and a bit more objective than to do a puff piece on him. And it's, well, not a puff piece.
The proof's of the pudding, isn't
I
it?
I think so. I think so.
And I think one thing I have to ask you is, he has, and I was going to ask you again this separately, this idea that he's in some respects the prototypical shock jock. He has this ability to say something that everyone thinks is a massive faux pas, but they don't stop think for a minute, he decided to do this for this reason. We'll come to that in a minute. But when you were researching this and recording it, how many times, if you'd had a mouthful of water, would you have gone, Jesus, I can't believe you said that?
Every 4 seconds.
Because you sent me a clip. You sent me a wonderful clip, which might be, and I don't want to give it away, but it was a comment he made about Frank Williams, who had just passed away. So we're talking about National Hero status, and he just said something that was so wonderfully cutting about him. I thought, no one would have the bravery to do that. Is it wrong to say something naughty about Sir Frank? Of course it's not, because he was a complicated human being. There are going to be people that have stories, but only Bernie would have had the bollocks at that point not to go, oh, he was the best, Frank was a wonderful, he just said something really negative. How many times did he do it?
Just, you know, 100 times a day, honestly. And the thing also, just with Frank, there's this incredible bond there. It's really difficult to explain. Do you know, the best way of describing it is that what he's doing is he's basically taking the piss out of his brothers. That's a really good way of thinking of him. They're not his sons. They're like his brother. They were brothers.
It's quite a British thing, isn't it? Yeah. If you're listening to this out of the UK, if you have close friends, you're nice to them, but you're really close friends, you're really, really close friends, you're horrible too.
It's hammer and tongs.
Yeah.
It's hammer and tongs. And, you know, and that was the point. They used to spend every working day trying to beat each other. But at the same time, Bernie, you know, said to me, you know, we were there for each other too. And I just put you back there again. This is a post-war sport.
Yeah.
In the war, this was not a remote control war. The Luftwaffe were bombing London, Coventry, Liverpool. People were dying on streets. They weren't dying in subtle, unseen ways. A street was gone, and a kid would go, oh, Mrs. Smith and her whole blah, blah, blah. Kids saw things that no child should see. And Bernie's a product of that war.
Yeah.
You know, he was 9 years old when that war started. And death, you know, people got, think about what aircraft were like.
Yeah.
You know, a guy puts your Spitfire together, you're trusting him with your life. Does this remind you of a sport at all? And you get up into this plane, you get to the speed at which you're supposed to take off, and the thing maybe does or maybe doesn't. You go to land, maybe the wheels come down, maybe they don't. You press the button when you've got the Messerschmitt in your sight, and maybe the guns work, maybe they don't. It's all life and death. And now in that context, just 5 years later, we have the first Grand Prix, the Grand Prix d'Europe, 13th of May, 1950.
There it goes.
And Bernie's, no, but Bernie's there. Bernie's there as a fan, right? And this is the point, he's 20 years old and he's there as a fan, and it's in the context of the war. And this is why I try to explain this to people, that people saw death in different ways then, but he fundamentally, I think what makes him kind of a great human being is he changed. A lot of people just accepted it, he didn't. And some cynical people say, well, that's because, you know, TV didn't want to show death all the time. I think that's nonsense. I think people love it. You know, as I said, the viewing figures went up after Senna's death, not down. And this is the whole thing, you know, you've got to have a bit of a moral compass. And Bernie could drive a car. He became a team manager, you know, a driver manager, team manager, you know, then he went and became this impresario. I mean, he's done all the jobs, if you like. And this is a guy who understands the sport from the ground up, as well as from the top down deal wise. And I think that makes him fascinating, insightful. I actually love that gallows humour that generation have. You've got to remember, as a doctor, the vast majority of your patients are old.
Yeah.
Okay, and, you know, little children don't break their hips when they slip on ice. Older grandmas do, older granddads do. And we talk to them on the wards afterwards. What do you think? Where do you think their humour is? Do you think some guy in his sort of late 70s sees a good-looking nurse? Do you not think he transforms into Sid James in that moment?
Yeah.
Of course he does. Does that make him evil? I don't think it does. I think you have to have a little bit of latitude about people.
Yeah.
It's about respect, you know? And I think respect at all costs is quite an evil thing, actually. You've got to respect me. Do you understand? Do you know who I am? You know, I am the customer. Well, you could be a rude customer, in which case, does the shop assistant have to respect? Do they? I'm not sure that they do. I think respect's a real two-way street. You try to put yourselves in the shoes of someone else. Okay, if you try to do that, try to empathize in your life, make you a good filmmaker, that's the first thing.
Yeah.
That actually makes you a pretty good human being. And actually, if someone can see that you can see their point of view and then argue that their point of view is wrong, I would argue that you will probably change their minds better doing that than shouting at them.
Yeah.
Telling them they're this, telling them that.
Was there any point at which you discovered a level of ruthlessness that you were uncomfortable with Bernie, or that you thought, I need to give the viewer a note to know that this is he's a bit, he's overstepped the mark here, or this is too much? Were there any points like that or not?
I mean, weirdly, not quite in the same way that you say it, but there's a moment when Francois Servais is killed at Watkins Glen. You'll see that today. Bernie tells Reutemann to get in the car. And Reutemann's seen what's happened. And he explains it to him in a very nice way, but he does basically tell him to drive.
Yeah.
This is a race at which Jackie Stewart just walked away. You know, he couldn't drive, and Bernie told Reutemann to drive. You know, you remember that great line in the film Grand Prix, when I used to see an accident, I used to slow down, now I put my foot down even harder because I know all my opponents are going to be lifting.
Yeah.
And sometimes there are moments like that, you know, which I thought, oh my God, you know. But I think what I've given him a chance to do is just tell you from his point of view. Now, we don't interview anyone else. Everything else is in archive or on the news or in a, you know, in a headline. So you can make your own decision and decide if I'm kissing ass for 8 hours or not. I would argue that doing something in a very, very partial way, as long as all the other things are there for you to make your own decisions about, you decide whether he's ruthless. You decide whether you think he owned the business that he sold. I fundamentally think he did. I don't think he ever pulled a fast one. I think, weirdly, actually, I think it was in such annoyingly plain sight that all the other people, they were really furious because of it, actually. They were furious that they all wanted to just drive cars regularly. Look at Formula One today. How many teams in Formula One were set up by the people who managed them?
Bloody hell.
None.
Not a single
right?
one.
The last one died.
Yeah, Frank.
No. It was actually Didi Mateschitz.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, yes,
the last
yes.
one died. And so think about the relationship you have with a business as a proprietor, as a founder, compared to the business as a manager. A lot of people argue that Bernie took Formula One as far as he could take it. I guess that's hypothetical because we'll never know. But if you look at Formula One as it stands now, and I will talk only about Formula One here, it is now managed by professional managers.
Yeah.
They hire professional engineers. Some of them have been in Formula One all their lives. I think very few now. Are they the best at what they do? Possibly, I don't know. But what you have these professional managers, some of them with a motor racing background, some of them not. And now you have a professional media company who runs it. So the relationship between the bosses, the people who own the equity, the people who own the shares, and the professional managers is a fundamentally different relationship.
Is, yeah.
They can sit around a table and probably speak in management ease and look at graphs and look at TV projected figures and look at behind the scenes stuff. I mean, something very interesting and very revealing about Toto Wolff, when he was talking about the business with, I think, Perez and so on and so forth, he was saying, look, I don't think we need this out in the media. Now, you tell me 20 years ago, if a team boss would have said that about a rival team, they would have wanted it out in the media immediately.
Yeah.
So what am I saying? I'm saying it's probably no less at this point a competitive place, Formula One, in terms of, you know, put a driver in a car, he wants to win. Are there more pay drivers now? I doubt it. You know, it was always, you know, half the boys could, exactly, half the boys could afford it and the other half boys could really afford it. So, you know, it's how it worked. And but it is a different environment now. What you have is a primarily media business, and it was bought as a media business. When Bernie walked into it, it was a bunch of people who were just trying to beat each other week in, week out, get to the Grand Prix however they could, you know. And I think we should just not forget that transformation. The reason why I think people can take the sport now and do whatever they want to do with the sport, and we'll see what happens. You know, still, I think, relatively early days.
What you're triggering in me is the sense that he managed to turn it into box office with so few tools. Just imagine if when he started, he'd had Netflix, he'd had, I mean, what could he have achieved? One question I want to ask you, because we're going to have to wrap this up in a minute,
sure.
Even though it's lovely.
Sure.
But because it's wonderful, but we're going to come back, we're going to do a part two another time. I've always had a sense that there was a really impish, jokey side to him, that he would do pretty outrageous things just for his own amusement. You can imagine him buying a circuit for a laugh, you know, just doing unbelievable things because he had colossal wealth, but also just this sort of smirk that lurked there. Did you see this?
All the time. I have got so many outtakes where he just thought, I think I'll just take the piss out of you and I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it in a deadpan way and I'm going to see how long it takes you to work out that I've taken the piss out of you. I have to show you the outtakes sometimes. But I mean, there was one particular one where we were talking about ground effect and banning ground effect, and he was looking at me as if I was speaking to him in Swahili. So he then started, he looked into the camera and said, in 1982, Jean-Marie Balestre and Manish Pandey created the Balestre Pandey Formula One series. I don't know what they were doing at the time. I don't know what the rules were, but Manish Pandey seems to know. So perhaps we'll just turn the camera around and ask Manish Pandey what happened. I was just laughing so hard because he felt I was trying to sort of steer the agenda as to, you know, why skirts were banned. I was trying to make it too simple, if you like. And he was constantly, and it was, sometimes he'd also do, because we use a particular camera, the Interotron, he has to sit dead center.
Yeah.
As much as possible. You know, 2 hours of filming, 90-year-old man, you might slouch a bit or move to one side. And I'd occasionally go, can we just stop for a second? But he just go, okay, let's go again. And I remember there was one time, I think he saw me slouching. He went, Manish, can we just... It's like, always.
Yeah,
always.
I think the... I'll be clear here, because I think I might get some grief. I'm sure you're prepared for it. I don't align myself to anyone's code.
No.
I've got my own code, you've got your own code, and anyone listening's got their own code. But I'm not going to feel guilty about being fascinated by someone. I'm never going to feel guilty about that. This is someone who influenced not only motorsport, but actually the road car environment in ways that we probably wouldn't understand as well. And the idea that his life's going to be committed to film is really important, because so many things, we live in an era now of constant documentation. We can find stuff out. The internet's there, YouTube's there. But sadly, the years before 2005, there's not that much cataloguing of the things that we're fascinated in. You know, I wanted to research the Lamborghini Miura recently. There's no film about the Miura. No one made a film about the Ferrari F40. Why the hell not? But we are gonna have, thanks to you and Bernie and other people, we're gonna have a version of Bernie Eccleston's life. It might not be the truth, whatever, but it is. It's the only one that's been done.
I think that's exactly it. You know, we've had a go. I can't put words into his mouth. I wouldn't put words into his mouth. I think it's been an enjoyable process, but more than that, I have learned so much about myself in this. And I think that's the other reason why you do these things. You work out what it is about you that fell in love with this, or hated this, or had a problem with this. And it's, you know, the journey is yours as much as it is the other person's. You know, you bring your bias into it. There's no doubt you bring your bias into it. I think the lie is to turn around and go, this is the objective, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Maybe it is if you were a Martian and came down, spoke a different language. But God knows what that story would be.
Can you fit your free plug in now, please? Can you tell us where it'll be broadcast in the UK, maybe some other markets as well, because we'll have viewers outside the UK, and when it releases, and why people should really watch this soon?
I think if you like any form of motorsport at all, Formula One, rallying, whatever, right, motorcycles, you should watch this, because this is a man who in some ways actually embodies absolutely the sharp end of competition in every word that comes out of his mouth. It's so measured. He's so personally competitive. It's untrue. It's really worth watching it at that level. This is also a story about a particular kind of Briton, which I have always found really fascinating. These are real buccaneers. These are people who were getting knighthoods in the 16th century whilst the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Dutch were calling them pirates. These guys never had galleons. They didn't have the 40-gun ships. They had these 6-gun ships, but they knew every trade wind, every single cove, every barrier. They knew. So they would come out of nowhere, shoot the shit out of the back of your galleon, steal all your booty, and they were gone. That's what this story is about.
Yeah.
And it's about the absolute head honcho of that group of people. So it's about a Briton in a way that, listen, I mean, should we celebrate it? Yes. Why not? You know, it's great. They went out, they did something with their lives, you know? And that's, I think that's fantastic.
There was also, before you say when it's going to be on and where it's going to be on, there was a comment that someone wrote. There was a negative comment on that Instagram post that said, he took more than he gave, and I can't disagree more. The one thing I would say about, for all the controversies, for all the divisiveness, for all the, you know, for the accusations of poor behaviour, let's look at what he built. Sure, of course he gave us, not in terms of money, but he gave us in terms of entertainment, in terms of fascination, far more than he's taken for me. Irrefutable.
Better words than mine are Murray Walker's. This is actually quite heartbreaking. I was desperate. I gave Murray a call when I'd finished my first lot of filming, and he was in his home at the time, and he said to me, congratulations. And I said, what for? And he said, for getting as far as you have. I said, we haven't edited a thing. He said, listen, I've known this man for 60 years. Already where you've got to, no one else has ever got to, and he's a great man. Murray said this, not Manish,
yeah.
Right? And Murray said, what he has done for the sport is impossible to quantify. He has built this sport. You know, Murray Walker said that. And what breaks my heart is when we'd finished the trailer, the original trailer, we transferred it to him. It never got downloaded. Murray died. And it, you know, I live with that one. You know, I think he would have just loved the trailer. He would have. I could see Murray grinning at that trailer because I think Murray really saw what Bernie did. And yeah. Murray was no mug, you know, no way.
No. So where and when?
So in the UK, Warner Brothers Discovery have bought it, so it will come out all 8 episodes on the Discovery Plus channel on the 27th of December.
Excuse me, 27th of December.
So in Italy, Japan, Spain, and Germany, Austria, Switzerland, I think it's DAZN, Viaplay have got it for the Scandi countries, Poland, the Baltic states, and Latin America, Disney, ESPN, which is very exciting. I think we should be able to announce our American and Middle Eastern partners fairly soon.
Yep.
So it'll come to you. It'll find its way to you in the new year.
Can you tell us about any new targets coming up or not? Because the subject matter is so ripe for this audience, and clearly you're at the top of your game at the moment, so you're not going to leave it here.
No, really don't want to leave it. Okay, so there's a car, it's a brand that we're all in love with.
Yeah.
It's best in one colour, and there's one person on earth who can really tell you that story.
And if you can't work that out, you don't deserve to be listening to this podcast.
Exactly.
Manish, that's a wonderfully enlightening hour and 34
minutes. Oh my God, okay.
But thank you so much for taking the time. And it's not the last time we'll speak to you because I'll come back and we'll do the other sides. But thank you so much for sharing your story. And go and click on some of the old podcasts. This is the first of a new batch. There's going to be more because Edward's told me I've got to do more. And on the back of that one, I'll quite enjoy making them.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.